Two dear people right here have had their hands up till they've almost frozen in place. And then right here, and then there's, oh gosh, Linda wants one. Yeah, these are the last ones right here. Linda, you're out of luck. Pam, could you get one or two more? Oh, here's one. Here's one. There we go. The Lord will provide. Five loaves and two fish. I don't even know what I was saying. Probably didn't matter at all. We have our sister church down in Orlando, Florida, and they join us many times. And so don't ever forget that they are a part of us. And just like all of us, they're struggling to try to do what God wants them to do there. And it's a church plant, so that's always a huge challenge. That's never easy. So we're glad to have those who join us online. We have people that will come to our website and watch these lessons and messages throughout the week or weeks. So we have a pretty large footprint. Even though we have struggled with our live streaming, and we are working to remedy that, and that's no one person's fault. It's just a lot of things. We've struggled with that. Sometimes we're on and we're good, and then other times we have all kinds of issues. So sometimes our online audience has waned a little, but we are delighted that you're here today. Thank you for joining us. We are teaching the second part of this lesson, which is maybe Hitler was right after all. We've been preaching on truth, or teaching on truth, as you can see. And so when we think about Adolf Hitler and the huge crowds that he was able to draw and all of the things that he was able to do with such a small country, even though Germany is big in its own right, obviously, but compared to, let's say, North America, it's not. He was able to send his troops all over Europe and occupy these countries and convince the youth of Germany to fight for that which probably most of them would not have even supported. The brown shirts did. They committed horrible atrocities, as this picture can attest. And in the end, many, of course, lost their lives. And what we remember the most about Nazi atrocities, even though probably doesn't do it justice because they were wicked to everybody, is what happened to mostly Jews in those concentration camps, but not only Jews, all kinds of political and religious dissidents were so horribly treated in those camps, as these pictures obviously illustrate. And then, of course, when they would put these people to death, they would use these crematoriums to get rid of the remains so that they could compress all of their wickedness. Well, in the midst of all of that, if there's no objective standard, as Norm Geisler reminded us last week, then life is nothing but a glorified Monopoly game. You can acquire lots of money, lots of property. When the game's over, it's all going back in the box. So if there's no truth, if there's no objective standard for truth, that person and this person are basically the same. I mean, not the same person, but their beliefs and all are equally valid. They're equally holy or equally non-holy, because if there's no truth, then there's none of that. We saw that even God's people struggled with this. There was a day in Israel when everyone did what was right in his own eyes. They defined truth in their own terms. So last week we said everyone instinctively knows the difference between right and wrong. Everyone knows that. There's a prescription for good, and every prescription, of course, has to have a prescriber. Every law has a lawgiver. There is, we know, a moral law. We all know this instinctively. Therefore, there must be a moral lawgiver. It's not just the law of the jungle. In fact, a professor in the University of Texas in Austin said, everyone knows certain principles. There is no land where murder is virtue and gratitude is vice. In fact, he went on to say that this basic knowledge of right and wrong is what we can't know. We just instinctively know it. This is why Jefferson said there are certain self-evident truths. They're self-evident. You don't have to be taught them. In fact, C.S. Lewis said, think of a country where people were admired for running away in battle, where a man felt proud of double-crossing all the people who had been kindest to him. You might just as well try to imagine a country where two and two made five, until Common Core math, of course. Then when that came along, that happened too. Well, we live in a land today where that's kind of the rule. So the second thing that we saw is that moral law is undeniable. The father of situational ethics, Joseph Fletcher, said, "The situationalist avoids words like never, perfect, always. He avoids them like the plague, as he avoids absolutely." They don't want these. So those who deny all values definitely value their right to make that denial. So in other words, they're a contradiction of their own said philosophy. They say there's no moral values, but they value their right to say that. Well, then there's moral values. This is like saying one should never say never. We should always avoid using the word always. See, it's circular reasoning. It's self-incriminating. Our reactions, number three, help us to discover the existence of moral law. To prove that the moral law is written on the minds and hearts of all people, treat them unfairly or immorally, and watch what happens. I know I'm going through this quickly, but that's what we covered last week. So if someone says, "Well, I don't believe in the moral law," well, then do something awful to them and watch how quickly they believe in the moral law. I've often said, somebody says, "Well, you know, this is my truth and your truth. And so my truth is you can go into any store in certain cities in America, and as long as you don't steal $1,000 worth of stuff, we're not going to prosecute." You realize there are towns now in the U.S. where you can do that. So stores are having to abandon parts of New York City, for instance, because people can go in there and steal $950 worth of stuff, and they're not going to be prosecuted. Now, just imagine if you do that on a daily basis. And if you have a way of disposing of that, selling it, you can make a pretty good living. Well, so if somebody says, "Well, I don't believe in moral law," steal something from them and watch how fast they believe in moral law. The moral law is not always the standard by which we treat others, but it is nearly always the standard by which we expect others to treat us. You see that? See, so all people know that there's a moral law. We all know there's truth. So this business of there is no truth, and this is my truth and your truth, and they don't have to be the same, that's nonsense. There would be no human rights without moral law. Our framers who wrote these words, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights." Well, that wouldn't have happened because we hold these truths to be self-evident. Well, if there's no truth, then how could you have any kind of liberty? You couldn't be free to leave your home and go work during the day, because if there's no truth, no moral law, while you're away working, somebody will come in and steal all your stuff. So you'd have to stay home and guard your stuff. Well, then you couldn't make a living. See, a civil society is based upon its ability to adhere to a moral code. Where do you think we got that code? Why do you think it is that for a couple of centuries now, it's been wrong in America to practice polygamy, or what we are now calling polyamory? Why was marriage between two people and that's it, and it happened to be a male and a female? Where did we get that idea? Well, God's word establishes that truth. Why is it wrong to rob a bank? I mean, it's wrong to rob a bank. A few bank robbers don't think so, but they eventually figure out that it was wrong. But why is it that that's wrong? Why have we decided all of these things are wrong or are right? Did we just kind of sit down one day and say, "Well, let's make a list of the things that we are going to decide are wrong. Let's make a list of those things"? No, God made that list. See, this is why all of this is so. So those who were being tried at the Nuremberg trials after World War II were convicted of violating what? Basic human rights. And how do you know what those are? They're defined by moral law. That's why this is so important. Now, this is why I believe that today you probably couldn't have the Nuremberg trials. You probably couldn't have them. They'd get off on some kind of technicality. You know why? Because we have jettisoned our belief in moral law. We still do lip service to it, but we don't do it. Look at what is being done through the Department of Justice to these pro-life demonstrators. They're using vaguely written laws like the FACE Act to go into people's homes in the middle of the night or in the early hours of the morning, waving around fully automatic weapons, 20 or 30 FBI agents, to forcibly arrest those who are nonviolent people. And they have a history of being nonviolent. Look at what they did to Mike, the pillow guy. Mike Lindell, thank you. Stopped him, jumped on him at a Hardee's and took his phone from him. Now, how is that possible? Well, it's possible in a culture that has jettisoned moral law. Therefore, when moral law is gone, human rights don't exist. They're whatever we tell you they are. Well, once the government reserves the right to grant you rights, it also reserves the right to take those away. This is why our framers were so brilliant, but not so brilliant. They just read God's word and they understood. I'm not saying they were all believers, but they all had a respect for the principles in Scripture, and they understood that our rights don't come from government. Our rights come from God. In fact, governments come from people, not people from government. You got to remember that the colonies created what we call the federal government. And while they were doing that, they were in great fear and trembling that that doggone central government, or what some called general government, would overflow its banks. And they tried to put all these checks and balances. Well, guess what? Didn't work. And today now, we have a behemoth federal government, basically because of the disengagement of God's people. Half of us don't even vote, and the half that are registered to vote, half of us are not registered to vote, the half that are registered to vote, about 40% vote. Christians. Well, this is why. Now you say, well, why won't they? Because they're not led by their pastors to do it. Their pastors won't even touch those subjects. You know that. We've been over that a gajillion times. But you see all the connections? So see, there's no mystery as to why we're in the mess that we're in. Why we're repeating history again. Why we're walking down the very same road that those Nazis did. We're using the same, well, we're not, but the left are using the same arguments they used. What's the old saying? Those who do not learn from history are destined to repeat its mistakes. Notice it's always the mistakes. Why is that? Because we're fallen. You have to teach kids to do right. You don't have to teach them to do wrong. They got that from their grandmother. Right, guys? In my grandchildren's instance, that's totally true. So notice then, it's so important. These principles are so important. So we get to number five. We cannot know justice, injustice, or right or wrong without the moral law. So there's no court system ultimately that you can count on. And notice how our court system in some places is failing us miserably. I just heard the story this week of a couple that had gotten crossways with some things, and they hadn't committed any crime whatsoever. They had not been indicted of a crime, but the FBI came in and seized all of their assets. They lost their home. They froze their bank accounts. Their bank accounts showed zero balance, and had they not had actual jobs at the time, they wouldn't have had any way to buy food for their children that week. You say, well, that can't happen in America. It's happening all the time. It's just the left news won't tell you. Glenn Beck did an entire program where he interviewed people who are being railroaded by this out-of-control government. Now, why is that? It's because the Dems are in charge? Well, that's part of it. But it's because they, as a party, have rejected moral law. But not far behind them are many of the Republicans as well. They've rejected moral law. Well, then ultimately there's not going to be any justice or injustice. So this is why Alan Dershowitz, if you remember, I played the recording early in this series. Alan Dershowitz said you can't ever know what's wrong. You can only experience what's wrong and then you know what's wrong. What? He said, but we can know what's right. Or wait, I think I have that backwards. He said, we can't know what's right, but we can know what's wrong because it's painful to us. That is nonsense. I mean, because even though you may think it's a wrong, the person doing it to you may think it's a right. I mean, they burned people like Tyndale for trying to print the Bible. Well, they must have thought it was right. It wasn't. But they burned people trying to translate the Bible into English. You tell me that's a crime? Well, they said it was. Well, did that make it right? No, but see, that's the problem. So when you have guys like Alan Dershowitz, that even though recently he stood on the right side of some things, he has a lifetime as a professor at Harvard teaching wrong concepts. You can't ever know what's right. You can only know what's wrong. Well, that's nonsense. You can't know what's wrong if you don't know what's right. So he says one cannot know what is wrong unless one knows what is right, vice versa. If one states that he has the truth that no one has, then he would have to know the truth himself. So in other words, if you say, well, there's a truth and the truth is there is no truth, well, then you must know what the truth is. So there must be truth. You see what I'm saying? See, this is, I know it all sounds crazy, but this is the problem. This is the world in which we live. Or Dan Rather could say something like this. Someone can lie about any number of things and still be an honest person. I played that recording for you a few weeks ago. I mean, he actually said that. He said it to Bill O'Reilly. Bill O'Reilly was interviewing him, and he said, a man, he was referring to Bill Clinton, he said, a man can lie about any number of things and still be an honest person. That's an oxymoron, unless you do not believe in moral law, but you believe in relativism or what we used to call situational ethics. I decide what's right or wrong, and that may change by tomorrow. Now, look at what's happening to us currently. Tell me that we're not under that kind of thinking in this age. That's why a series like this is so vital. So C.S. Lewis says, and you know, realize that C.S. Lewis, before he became a Christian, was an atheist. He said, as an atheist, my argument against God was that the universe seemed so cruel and unjust. But how had I got this idea of just and unjust? A man does not call a line crooked unless he has some idea of a straight line. What was I comparing this universe with when I called it unjust? You see, how could you know? How could you know if something's unjust if you don't know what's just? So you can't. So he said, one of my fallacies was I had no standard. There was no standard by which I could tell whether the line was crooked or straight. You've heard this illustration before, but let me use it. We could take four or five of us and say, I want you to tell me how long or how wide you think this room is. We could all start guessing. And unless we know exactly, we're going to have to guess. Some would be better at guessing than others, but I bet you we'd all be wrong. You say, well, how would we know? I believe it's that long. Well, here's how we'd know. We get out a measuring tape, and we actually stretch it out, and we'll know exactly how long this room is. How? Well, that's a standard. See, that's a standard of measurement. Though we might guess close, we would be wrong. That's why we must have a standard. So Norman Geisler says, I've never met a Jewish person who believes that the Holocaust was just a matter, that should say matter, not natter, that the Holocaust was just a matter of opinion. I mean, even Dershowitz will get all steamed up over the Nazi concentration camps and all that if you start asking him about it. Well, just ask him if this is just a matter of opinion, Alan. Ask Mark Levin if the whole Jewish concentration camp treatment, all that, it's just a matter of opinion. They just had a different opinion than the Jews did, really. Because that's what we're hearing today, isn't it? Well, that's just your opinion. Really? So we just decide based upon opinion as to what's right or wrong. So this is how people in power could say, here's what we're going to do. We're going to hire an additional 87,000 IRS agents, and we're going to require that they take training in using firearms, and they must sign a form that they are willing to use lethal force. Now, just think about that for a moment. IRS agents, whether or not they'll ever be trained, we'll see. IRS agents who agree to use lethal force, to who? Upon who? I mean, what? First of all, I've never paid my taxes to an IRS agent. I've always paid them to the U.S. Treasury, either by automatic withdrawal from the bank, or by writing a check. There's never been a need to send armed IRS agents to people's homes to wave a gun in their face and say, pay up your taxes or else. Now, we all laugh about this, but this is a lot like Robin Hood. Right? I mean, isn't that the scenario that is used to either fictionally or not create this figure known as Robin Hood? And many believe he was actually a real figure. Maybe he wasn't called Robin Hood as we know it. But it was the situation with no ethics, with no moral law. So therefore, he who has the guns makes the rules. For years in America, it's been the golden rule. He who had the gold made the rules. But now we've gone a step further and we're going to force it. So I had someone ask me the other day, they said, well, isn't our tax system with the IRS voluntary? I said, here's how you can know. You know that Harry Reid argued that when he was still in Senate, right? Harry was a senator. Yeah, he argued in an interview that our tax system is voluntary. Well, then I'm not going to pay. I mean, if it's voluntary, then I'm not going to do it. What he meant was, he's playing with words. What he means is, you've got to voluntarily file your taxes. That's what he meant. See, he's twisting with words. But we all know that if you don't file your taxes, of course, the deadline is April the 15th of each year. If you don't voluntarily file your taxes, what will the IRS help you to do? They will help you to volunteer. So it's not a voluntary system. Because if it's voluntary, you can't audit people. You can't penalize people. By the way, notice that when you owe them money, there's interest that you pay them and penalties. When they owe you money, right. Right. Here's another fallacy with the IRS, and unfortunately now it's becoming the FBI, this family that was accosted by the FBI. You are typically in America innocent until proven guilty. But now we've flipped it upside down. You are guilty until you can prove yourself innocent. Well, that's sometimes hard to do. It's very difficult to prove a negative. It's very hard to do. And so with the IRS, they can come in with what they call probable cause and not just audit you, they can freeze all your assets. And then you'll have to pay attorneys thousands and thousands of dollars to prove that you're innocent, and in the process may go bankrupt. And after a year or two, the IRS may concede that you were innocent. And here's your money back. Unfortunately, there is no money because you've spent it all up in legal fees. Now, how does that happen in a country that was founded on the opposite of that? We gave up on moral law. See, it's as basic as that. It's just a matter of opinion now. It's my opinion that polyamorous relationships should receive the same protection under the U.S. Constitution as heterosexual or as same-sex marriages. That's what a judge in New York City just ruled a few weeks ago. And guys like Paul and I have been warning that not only was homosexual marriage going to be legalized, which now that's moot point, that's history. We've been arguing for years the next step is polyamory. The next step after that is pedophilia. The next step after that will be legalized anything, including bestiality. I'm telling you, friends, we are there. Now you say, well, okay, live and let live. If they want to be in a polyamorous relationship, that's their right. Okay, here's the problem with that. Number one, we're embracing the precept or the principle that there's no such thing as marriage under God. See, God who defined marriage, well, we're admitting, well, that's not his idea, it's our idea, so we have the right to redefine it. But let's create a scenario. Let's say that we know someone named Paul who claims to be a preacher. who used to operate a vending business. And let's say in that vending business, he offers spousal health benefits as a way to entice good, solid workers and to reward hard work. He will not only cover the insurance of the person that he employs, but he'll cover the spouse, assuming that it will be one spouse. Now, what if someone he has hired decides they want to get into a polyamorous relationship and there are 40 people involved in that polyamorous relationship? And the courts have said that that deserves the same protection under the U.S. Constitution as original heterosexual marriage. And then this person comes to Paul and gives him a list of all of the beneficiaries who need to be added to his coverage. And Paul has to pick up the health insurance for another 39 spouses. You say that'll never happen in America. You hide and watch. So what would Paul be forced to do? Well, Paul would have to be forced then to stop giving spousal benefits to get away from that. Then what if the court said, well, Mr. Blair, you can't do that because you're violating their civil rights. And so it looks like to us that you stopped giving spousal benefits because you don't agree with their right to be in a constitutionally protected polyamorous relationship. So they have the right to sue you. You think they will? What about all these bakers and others that are being sued by some of them, people they knew that they had a friendly relationship with, but the baker said, you know, I'm a Christian and I just can't bake a cake for a same-sex marriage. It violates my religious convictions. Well, the baker was found guilty and fined. See what I'm saying? So don't say this stuff doesn't affect me because I'm never going to be in a polyamorous relationship and it's just live and let live. No, it isn't live and let live. You're not living on an island by yourself. Paul often uses this illustration when he speaks at our training camps on Sunday evening, and he talks about how, I think it's on Sunday evening when he used it, but he says, if I lived on an island, and maybe it's Monday morning in the principles, but anyway, if I lived on an island and it was just me, I don't need curfew laws. I don't need signal lights. Because it's just me. Now, if I have two people or three people or four people, the more people that we have, the more we have need of certain protections, right? Because we're going to start to violate each other's space and peace and quiet, all that kind of stuff. So you've heard it before. It's just like the guy who had been on the island for years and years and finally was rescued. And as they're sailing away and he's delighted to be saved, he's pointing out to them, said, now over there was my house where I lived. And then there's my church. And they said, well, what's that other structure? He said, oh, it's the church I used to go to. And I got mad at them and I went to a different church. And they assumed he was a Baptist because, you know, that's what, he was the only guy there. So Geisler says, I've never met a Jewish person who believes that the Holocaust was just a matter of opinion. But today we're being told this is all a matter of opinion. So there's a huge difference in saying that meal was wonderful versus the Holocaust was wonderful. Now, no one would say that. But using the mentality of our age, it's just as right to say the Holocaust was wonderful as it is to say that meal was wonderful. Remember, with no objective truth, Hitler may have been right after all. Number six, there is no way to measure moral differences without the moral law. C.S. Lewis says, the standard that measures two things is something different from either. Just think about that. You'll know it's true. We have two sticks here. They're not the same length. We want to know what the length of each one of them is. Do we use the other one to measure the other one? No, we use something separate from them, which is a measuring tape or a ruler. And then we know how long both of them are. Now, we can know how long each of them are in proportion to one another, but that doesn't tell us how long they are. So a standard of measurement is different from... So if the moral law doesn't exist, then statements like murder is evil, racism is wrong, racism is wrong, and child abuse is wrong have no objective meaning. Who says it's wrong? If truth is in the eye of the beholder, if I decide what truth is, and it's based upon my convictions, my opinions, then who's to say that racism is wrong? Maybe racism is a virtue. Now, we know it isn't. So I want to be real careful to say that really fast. Because somebody's going to say, they'll use that little clip and say, Fisher said racism is a virtue. No, I didn't. It is not a virtue. But see, we could say that if there's no such thing as moral standard, no such thing as moral law, moral truth. So this is how the Washington Times last year and it was just a hit piece to try to paint up preachers like Paul and myself as right-wing, radical, theocracy establishment guys. So we're white Christian nationalists. And they said in that article, quoting me, that I wanted to rule America. Now, not personally, but the black robe preachers to be in charge. Well, I've never said that. In fact, not only have I never said that, I actually go to great pains to say the opposite. The last thing I want to see is a theocracy. But the problem is, if you live in a world where there's no moral law, no moral truth, no moral standard, I can take a little soundbite from someone and twist that and make them say anything I want them to say. It's my opinion. It's my truth as I see it. If moral relativism is false, then an objective moral law exists. Now, really, that's the wrong way to say it. We all understand that. Actually, the way to say that is, since the moral law exists, moral relativism is false. But we're arguing backwards here because we're arguing, what if there was no moral law? C.S. Lewis, back to him, he says, the moment you say that one set of moral ideas can be better than another, you are, in fact, measuring them both by a standard, saying that one of them conforms to that standard more nearly than the other. But the standard that measures two things is something different from either. So that's the full quote from a while ago. So how do I have, because a lot of people say, well, who gave you the right to say that? And I'll always say, I didn't say that. I'm repeating someone else. Well, who are you repeating? Blair? I would never do that. Not in a... who are you repeating? Blair? Well, sometimes... But you know who he's quoting? Same person I'm quoting. God. So when someone says, who gives you the right to say that Jesus is the only way to heaven? I didn't say that Jesus is the only way to heaven. He said he's the only way to heaven. I'm quoting him. So your problem's with him, not me. I'm repeating him. By the way, that's an easy way in that argument. Lewis goes on to say, you are in fact comparing them, two different things, both with some real morality, admitting that there is such a thing as a real right, independent of what people think, and that some people's ideas get nearer to that real right than others. Or put it this way, if your moral ideas can be truer and those of the Nazis less true, well then there must be something, some real morality for them to be true about. Does that make sense? Yeah. So obviously what he's doing is he's arguing the existence of moral law. We're almost there, guys. Number 7, there are no moral grounds for political or social dissent without the moral law. There are no grounds for political or social dissent without the moral law. How could you say this is an injustice if you don't know what justice is? How do you know? How do you know this was an injustice? This is how people, summer before last, could gather together and burn places and riot and call it the expression of justice, while news reporters are standing in front of the burning cars saying this is basically a peaceful demonstration. And the place is burning down behind them. Is this how you do that? Or just like the guy that was trying to report the gusts of this storm. And I think, Paul, you're the one that played the video. And it shows two turkeys go walking by. And this guy standing like this reporting. And then behind him, two guys just go walking by, you know. They blew his cover. No moral law. With no moral law, no position on any moral issue is objectively right or wrong. Who's to say that murdering a preborn baby is wrong? Who said that? Ronald Reagan. I've noticed all those in favor of abortion are already born. I want you to listen to this. This is out of the book. I don't have enough faith to be an atheist. Without a moral law, there would be nothing objectively wrong with Christians or Muslims forcibly imposing their religion on atheists. There would be nothing wrong with outlawing atheism, confiscating the property of atheists, and giving it to Pat Robertson or Sean Hannity. There would be nothing wrong with gay bashing, racism, or imperialistic wars. There would be, there would be nothing wrong with prohibiting abortion, birth control, and even sex between consenting adults. In other words, without the moral law, atheists have no moral grounds to argue for their pet political causes. There is no right to an abortion. I apologize for these typos. There is no right to an abortion, homosexual sex, or any of their other political sacraments, because in a non-theistic world, there are no rights. Unless atheists claim that there is a God and that his moral law condones or commands these activities, then their positions are nothing more than their own subjective preferences. In other words, the atheist has to believe in God to be able to demand their rights. I love that. And no one is under any moral obligation to agree with mere preferences or to allow atheists to legislatively impose them on the rest of us. You know, see what they're arguing here? With no moral law, everybody's in a mess. So just a few other things here, and then we're gonna wrap up this lesson. There are a few things that we need to understand. The difference between an assertion and an argument. Because a lot of people say, well, you're just asserting that. No, I'm arguing that. So here's the difference. An assertion merely states a conclusion. So in other words, I believe it's perfectly fine to abort a baby up till its birth moment. That's what California just decided, along with Vermont and Michigan. You can kill a baby on its birthday. On the other hand, an argument states the conclusion and then supports it with evidence. We Christians are not supposed to be making Christian assertions. Well, I believe this. Well, who cares what you believe? Why do you believe that? Well, my grandma used to say, well, that's not enough. Well, my mama used to say. It's like that guy that came up to me and said, I'm a Democrat, my grandpa was a Democrat, my dad was a Democrat. And I said, well, if your grandpa had been a moron and your dad had been a moron, would you choose to be a moron? So I just, you know, and you've heard that before. But that's no way of proving something in a substantive way. So what is an assertion? Well, I just make a conclusion. I don't have any evidence to support it. What's an argument? Well, an argument has a conclusion, but it has evidence to support it. So that's why Paul wrote the booklet, Not Blind Faith. There's evidence to Christianity. We always talk about faith, but we talk about a kind of faith that the Bible doesn't actually require. The Bible gives evidence. Another couple of contrasts here. Absolute morals versus changing behavior. And of course, you'll hear these days, get with it. This is the 21st century. Well, the problem is with that, if everything changes with every generation, then none of us have any rights. There can be no courts because you can't have justice because you don't know what justice is. You don't know what injustice is. You don't know what just is. So you can't have any of this. And then, of course, the ends versus the means. The left is good at justifying the means because they say, well, what we want is good. We want to protect the planet, so we want to control you. See, we're going to outlaw everything about you. Because, well, who doesn't want to protect the planet? Last time I checked out, I live here. I'd like to protect it too. Why shouldn't people murder, rape, and steal to get what they want if there's nothing beyond this world? Why shouldn't they? See, they're experimenting with that in New York. If you steal less than $1,000, we're not going to prosecute you. Okay, great. I'm going to steal $999 worth. See, what I'd do as a crook is I'd go in and take the price tags and write down everything till I got to $999, and then I'd load it up and go home. Because I'm not going to be prosecuted. That's not stealing. Stealing begins once I've stolen $1,000 worth of stuff. So these stores are shutting down like crazy. Well, can you blame them? They say, we can't stay in business in a culture like this. No, but see, if there's no moral law, why can't you just kill and murder and rape and steal? Why should the powerful cooperate with the weaker when the powerful can survive longer by exploiting the weaker? This is how communism works. No God, no moral law. We do whatever we want to do. Hitler says in Mein Kampf, if nature does not wish that weaker individuals should mate with the stronger, she wishes even less that a superior race should intermingle with an inferior one, because in such cases, all her efforts throughout hundreds of thousands of years, Darwinism, to establish an evolutionary higher stage of being may thus be rendered futile. But such a preservation goes hand in hand with the inexorable law that it is the strongest and the best who must triumph, and that they have the right to endure. He would live must fight. He who does not wish to fight in this world where permanent struggle is the law of life has not the right to exist. So this is the thinking that brought us to the concentration camps. So here's Peter Singer. Peter Singer has argued that parents should have the right to have a 3-month return policy on a child so they could kill it 3 months after it was born if they decided it just didn't work out. He says the life of a newborn, he's talking about a human, is of less value than the life of a pig, a dog, or a chimpanzee. By the way, so you'll know that he has some influence, he's a professor at Princeton. Singer believes that parents should be able to kill their newborn infants now. He reduced it from 3 months to 28 days. In his book, Created from Animals, The Moral Implications of Darwinism, James, I don't know if it's Rachel's or Raquel's, but anyway, what are we to say about them, the mentally handicapped? The natural conclusion, according to the doctrine we are considering, Darwinism, would be that their status is that of mere animals. And perhaps we should go on to conclude that they should be used as non-human animals are used, perhaps as laboratory subjects or as food. Now, he's not saying that's right. What he's saying is that Darwinism is right. That's right. Obviously, he doesn't believe that. So here's a Darwinist, Randy Thornhill. He also writes with a guy named Craig Palmer. Notice he's holding up this card that says rape with a line through it. He says rape is a natural biological phenomenon that is a product of the human evolutionary heritage, just like the leopard spots and the giraffe's elongated neck. So he's arguing that rape is legal. Well, you see, in a world where there's no moral law, he's right. And we descend into darkness. That's where we are without truth. That's why a study of this type is so important. And that's how we've gotten to where we are right now. And friends, if we do not stop this, we're going to go just where the Nazis went. I'm telling you, that's where we're going. I don't want to go there, but that's where we're going. All right, thank you so much for being here. We have, I think, one more lesson in this series, and then we'll be done. So thank you for your patience. Let me finish that lesson. We'll have worship service here in about 13 and a half minutes. You're dismissed.